Hey everybody, I'm Katie Couric, and this is Next Question. So, I've written this memoir. It's out in just a few weeks. And as you might imagine, the process has really forced me to put my life in perspective. What I've realized is that when I look back at all of it, there's one moment that stands out as the thing I'm most proud of. And that is...
I have a pretty little colon.
That's right, showing the inside of my colon on morning television.
But you didn't put the scope in yet, did you?
Yeah, we're doing the examination.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh,
we're doing
okay,
it.
Okay, good. Well, that's a good sign.
We're doing it. We're almost done. You're going to feel a cramp there now.
There is a lot I've done in the fight against colorectal cancer, the number two cancer killer of men and women combined. I've raised hundreds of thousands of dollars. Yay me, established the Monahan Center, a comprehensive gastrointestinal cancer center at New York Presbyterian Hospital where my husband, Jay, was treated, and co-founded Stand Up to Cancer. But when I filmed my first colonoscopy and aired it on the Today Show, that up-close and personal view of my insides had an almost immediate impact. It prompted a lot of people to call their doctors and get screened. In fact, there was actually a study done on it. The University of Michigan found a 20% increase in colonoscopies as a result of my segment. They actually called it, yes, the Couric effect.
It's sharing the news. It's sharing the information so it doesn't happen to other people and they catch it.
Senator Amy Klobuchar knows what I'm talking about. In early September, the Minnesota Democrat revealed that back in February, she was diagnosed with stage 1 breast cancer. She had a lumpectomy to remove the cancer and then radiation. By August, her doctor said her treatment had gone well, but now she's on a mission to share her story and how it could have easily gone another way.
It's been so just amazing to hear all the stories that people have written me. They've called, I'm sure you had this when you went on the show and you did the colonoscopy and you made very clear that everyone should do this. You shocked people into thinking differently about it. And so the stories of people getting their exams going in has been incredibly rewarding, made it all worth it. And I'm wearing pink today to remind everyone, Breast Cancer Month, go in, get your screening.
Breast cancer is the most common form of cancer among women. In fact, every year, more than 250,000 women are diagnosed in the U.S. And like so many cancers, early detection can be life-saving. But with the pandemic, there's been an alarming drop in breast cancer screenings, down 87%. That's right, 87% compared to pre-pandemic numbers. For Senator Klobuchar, that statistic isn't all that surprising.
Like so many women, Katie, I put it off. I put it off through the pandemic. And at first that made sense, right? Because there were a lot of routine things weren't going on. But after a while, there was really no excuse except that I kind of just put it off. And then when I went in and got this routine mammogram is when I found out that I had stage 1A breast cancer. And I got that call. And you know from your own life, and you've been such a tremendous warrior to let people know how important screenings are after losing your husband and the whole story. It was unbelievable. And by the way, I thought about that a few times as this was going on. I then got that call and they said, those white spots that we saw, it's actually cancer. And then I immediately started talking to different doctors, made a plan, got a lumpectomy. A few months later, got the radiation. 2 days after my dad died, because of the Senate schedule, it was so hard to figure this all out. But I got the treatment in a timely manner, which was really good. But the exam I put off, and that's when I found out that, one out of three people put off exams, routine exams during the pandemic, still putting them off. And a whole bunch of women are walking around right now with undetected breast cancer, which is really scary. And so I've tried to, using you as a model, Katie, I've tried to really talk about this in that way, to remind people how you can save lives just by finding things out early. And I was on the cusp. I mean, I found it out, but I should have gone in a year earlier.
That's so true, Senator Klobuchar, and such an important message because so many people will lose their battles because they weren't the beneficiaries of early detection. And that is such a critically important message to get out. The earlier things are found, the easier they are to treat. I mean, it's really as simple as that.
Mm-hmm. They say my chances of getting it again are just like the general population. I think that's the miraculous nature of the treatments right now. One, they can tailor them depending on what stage it is and if you need chemo or a mastectomy and the like. But the earlier they catch it, the better you are, as you just said. And so I feel really good about the diagnosis. But a few things during that time that I realized. One, I was so grateful to my family, so much gratitude, because I actually decided I wasn't going to disclose everything at that moment because my dad was dying and I wanted a lot of the focus on him. We had the investigation of the insurrection at the Capitol, and I was in charge of that with three other senators. I was in charge of the hearings on the election bill, and there was just a lot going on, and I didn't want it to be about that, about me at that moment. I knew I was going to make it public, and so I waited till the end of the summer and did it then, and that worked out for me. But when people, public officials or not, when it starts to be a situation where they can't go to work, of course they're going to explain it. But I was able to work it around that and not do it. So even more so, I was so grateful to my family because they were like my husband getting up at 4 a.m. to take me to radiation days in a row. Of course, the doctors and nurses, the perfect strangers who didn't know that I had a lumpectomy and I wasn't supposed to lift my luggage up when I flew back and forth between Minnesota and D.C. I'd just stand there looking forlorn and they'd be like, can I help you? And so, you know, there were a lot of nice things and moments I remember of people helping me out, even when they didn't know they were doing it.
But, you know, thinking about what was happening in your life, your sweet dad dying, mm-hmm. Jim Klobuchar, of course, a newspaper columnist, and I know you all were very, very close. It sounds like you had the kind of relationship with your dad that I had with my dad, which I write a lot about. But, you know, I think about all these stressors going on at once. And honestly, my heart is racing a little bit just thinking about how you were able to manage everything coming at you at once. How were you able to manage all that?
Well, I always remember John McCain's last words to me, or the last thing he pointed to. I visited him at his ranch when he was dying and with Cindy, my husband, and he couldn't really talk very much. And he pointed to a word from his last book, a phrase, where he said, there's nothing more liberating than fighting for a cause larger than yourself. And for me, the work that I was doing at that moment, the combination of that investigation, which was focused on the security at the Capitol. Now there's a bigger one going on, of course, about the root causes and everything that happened, which needs to be investigated over in the House. But that, and then that election bill going on at the same time that we had to get through the committee, we had to get agreement with Senator Manchin, which we did over the summer. Now we have the process in front of us. But that was a cause larger than anything happening to me. So that was a lot of it. And then, as you said, my dad, he led this incredible life. He did everything from, you know, ride his bicycle around Lake Superior to covering a mafia funeral in Italy, to writing 23 books, to climbing the second highest mountain in Peru. I mean, he just had this incredible life. And he had Alzheimer's, so it was this long goodbye. And being there was important with someone with Alzheimer's, which we couldn't do the year because of pandemic. But being there at the end was important because you don't always know when someone with Alzheimer's is going to start talking again or remember certain things, which he often did sporadically. And the funniest part is some of the women who worked at the assisted living who loved him so much, they were, I think, Liberian, and they were learning English. And they had a dictionary next to his bed because he kept using so many new words for them and long words that they would look them up and learn them. So it was kind of cool. He was teaching to the end.
When we come back, I get curious about Capitol Hill, big tech, the January 6th insurrection, and yes, even the 2024 election. More with Senator Amy Klobuchar right after this. I'd love to ask you about a couple of the things you mentioned, mm-hmm. because obviously I'm watching this investigation into January 6th unfold, people refusing to testify. Do you think we're ever going to get to the bottom of what exactly happened? And additionally, do you think people will ever take it as seriously, or certain segments of the population will take it as seriously as you believe they need to?
That depends on the next year and some of my colleagues in the Republican Party. You know, Liz Cheney has really stood up and said, we are a democracy. We may have disagreements, but we are a democracy. And many of them haven't said that. And I think as leaders, more and more people need to do that. Everyone knows what happened that day of the insurrection. And in fact, that night, it was really quite cathartic. While a few people voted against the results of the Electoral College, that was a very small number in the Senate. Over 90% of them supported the Electoral College results, and that included some very conservative Republicans. That was a moment. The speeches people gave, some of them who had been thinking otherwise, who had switched their minds and switched their votes after what they'd seen that day. And I thought, probably naively, and especially as we got through the inauguration on that beautiful blue sky and everyone there and every leader of the Republican Party from Mike Pence to Bush to Quayle, except, and all of the congressional leadership was there with the Democrats, except, of course, Donald Trump, that I thought that we were going to move on. And that just isn't happening. When you look at public opinion polls, there's still a number of people that believe that Donald Trump won the election. And that is just wrong on every factual basis. Every local elected official would tell you that. Every secretary of state is just wrong. And so, you know, it is on us, and the Republican Party is going to have their own internal debate. And I think that is why this investigation, the bipartisan one over in the House now, we did our own in the Senate, which was really focused on, we need a new police chief. We've gotten a new police chief. We need to have better security plans. We have those. That's been witnessed by some recent events. We have to get more resources to the police and to the building, and we are doing that and have done that. So their investigation is really the root causes, Trump's role. That's why these subpoenas are going on and the like. And that's really important. You can't just dust it away and throw it under the rug, man. You have to get to the bottom of it so that history, at some point, you're going to have more and more people believing the truth. And you don't do that if you hide the truth.
But do you think we will get to the bottom of it? Or do you think this committee will be met with constant obstruction?
Yeah, no, I mean, they're going to keep trying. My favorite lately is that Steve Bannon, who wasn't even in the White House at the time of the insurrection, is claiming executive privilege. I guess that means any intern that ever worked in the White House can claim executive privilege for the rest of their lives. I don't think that's going to work. So, you know, that's the kind of thing the House committee is dealing with legally.
Another issue that you've been intimately involved with, of course, is the Freedom to Vote Act as a compromise bill to the For the People Act. You know, some have said it's a watered down version. Other people have said it's a necessary compromise. Without getting too much in the weeds, Senator Klobuchar, can you just talk briefly about why this had to be done? Because, you know, it's very hard to keep up with all the machinations that are going on Capitol Hill. And I think part of the problem is nobody really explains it simply for people who aren't just covering it every hour inside the Beltway.
I have a job. I'm about to do it. So the Freedom to Vote Act ensures that every American can vote safely, regardless of their zip code. Because right now, we've got states doing some really bad stuff and making it hard to vote, limiting vote by mail, limiting mail drop-off boxes. In Georgia right now, they passed a law that says you have to put your birth date on the outside of the envelope. And everyone messes up and puts the day that they're filing the ballot. These things are evil. They're meant to make it hard for people to vote. So what we put in place in this bill is federal standards that are minimal standards, but they say things like you have to have early voting. You have to be able to register the same day of the election and has some basic requirements in place. The compromises we made have really been well received from every editorial board to Stacey Abrams, Barack Obama are supportive of this bill because it is really strong. And Senator Manchin did work with me. I lead this bill. Senator Schumer brought us together, eight senators, including Senator Warnock and Padilla and many others. And we came together with this. So it is at its core about the basic standards, which the Constitution allows us to put in place. It also has a really good prohibition on dark money and allowing people to find out who's spending the money when the campaigns aren't spending it. And those are really the two main provisions, as well as some standards for when they set up congressional districts. The bad thing is called gerrymandering, and it has some standards in place for that. So we're really proud of the bill. And now, after we have an agreement, Joe Manchin's name is on this bill. Now we have to figure out the process, and that gets us into these archaic Senate rules about filibustering and the like. And my hope is that we find a way through that process, because state by state, there is an effort, which is a continuation of January 6th, to stop people from voting. In the words of Reverend Senator Warnock in Georgia, some people don't want some people to vote. And instead of changing their candidates or their platforms or their messages, unfortunately, right now, there are people in the Republican Party that said, you know, we don't want to do that. So we're going to try to change the voters. We're going to try to stop some of the people that voted last time and make it harder. In Georgia, you can't vote on weekends during the runoff period. I mean, all that was done to make it harder to vote.
You know, there have been a lot of articles, opinion pieces, observations from Robert Kagan to Bill Maher recently, talking about sort of this systematic erosion of voting rights that is taking place at the state level, really trying to set the scene for 2024 to say that the election is fraudulent, a continuation of what's been called the big lie. How concerned are you about that, Senator Klobuchar? Because it's almost like a sleeping giant that people are just starting to see. How can that be stopped? And would this bill actually do something that would override what's happening state by state by state?
Yeah, that is a great way to refer to it as a sleeping giant, because it's one of the reasons I argue for, by the way, abolishing the filibuster or carving it out for this, because people don't realize sometimes what's happening here. And what happened when Trump was contesting election results that were, by the way, Republican election officials and the like, they stood up. So this is why I'm not quite in the doomsday of some of the people who've addressed this. They stood up. Republican election officials, Secretary of State stood up for democracy. Local officials, whatever party they were, stood up and did their jobs. You remember them all counting the next day and everything
they
were doing.
I interviewed Brad Raffensperger during that period. And you're right, but aren't many of those people being replaced
systematically? Let me get to that. So in our bill, this Freedom to Vote Act, we actually have a provision we've adjusted that wasn't even in the original bill, because of what's going on, that says you can't fire local elected officials in the local county districts and the like without evidence of malfeasance, and we put a standard in place. Again, the Constitution of the United States says that Congress can make or alter laws regarding federal elections. That's why we feel so confident that this is going to stand up in court. So that would get to that. The other thing they're doing is with the Electoral College trying to upend that, and we have a second bill, Senator Warnock does, that would get at that. So there is many things that we need to do. And I really believe that in the end, the filibuster is stopping us. And it's just this archaic rule, Katie, that says you have to get to like 60 votes to advance anything. It's been changed many times in the past. And if we want to move on these really difficult, challenging issues like climate change or immigration reform, or voting, or even tech rules of the road, I think it's going to be really hard with that archaic rule still in place. So I do get back to that, but especially on voting, I'm hopeful there may be a way to do something different because it's, our very democracy depends on it.
But how do you get rid of the filibuster?
We would have to vote on a 51 vote margin. We would all have to do it. And right now it wouldn't appear that Senator Manchin and Sinema will get rid of it, but they could reform it. You could look at different ways to reform it. In the past, reforms have included reducing the number of senators from, it was 67 to 60, you could reduce it further. You could carve out the filibuster for certain things, like say the debt ceiling. You could require, and Senator Manchin has indicated a willingness to support this, a standing filibuster. And this is really an interesting idea. It, like in the old days where they had to actually speak, it would be a change of rule that you'd have to get with 51 votes because it wouldn't just, you just can't do it. And then it would require them to actually be there, you know? So when a bunch of them
like
are
when
off,
Ted Cruz read Green Eggs and Ham?
Yeah, except that was just a showman thing. They would actually have to be there. Some people would have to be there all the time for sudden votes and speaking and the like. And then you could ramp it down to a certain number and have an ultimate vote, something like that. But remember, the civil rights legislation of the 60s, you know, that was filibustered. And in the end, it just went on and on. Finally, there was an agreement.
And I love this story, and so I'm going to read it to you. Do you like Green Eggs and Ham? I do not like them, Sam I Am. I do not like Green Eggs and Ham.
We'll be right back. I don't know if you saw SNL last week, but they were sort of making fun of how clueless members of Congress are because they just, in fairness, don't really understand technology and social media.
Mm-hmm. My question is, I have 2,000 friends on Facebook. Is that good?
Is it good?
Like, is that a lot? 2,000 sounds like a lot. How many does Drake have, 4,000?
I think he has like 50 million.
Oh my God. Well, no wonder he never answered my poke.
I'm curious if you think we've reached a tipping point with the whistleblower and kind of the fact that Facebook is really nefariously failing to take certain measures to stop all the damaging effects of social media. And there's some good ones. I think there's some positive things about it too.
Yes.
But, you know, when you look at this problem and how it impacts so much of our society, what do you think is the solution? How do you balance free speech and controlling misinformation that I think mm-hmm. has, as President Obama says, is one of the most is the most serious threat to our democracy?
Exactly. So let's step back. A loaded question, to be sure.
I don't mean it to be loaded. I'm concerned like you are, I'm sure.
I am. I wrote a whole book on antitrust, and a lot of the focus was tech. I don't think they've made fun of me for not knowing what I'm talking about.
No.
But I
you
do
were,
think...
I don't think you were in the skit.
I wasn't, and I've been in several skits. I even have my own person, Rachel Dratch, that plays me, so I'm feeling good about that. But... I will say that one of the methods they use, honestly, is they make fun of everyone. Tech says, oh, they don't know what they're doing. And, you know, Saturday Night Live can make fun. I don't blame them. But the point is that I think we know enough to know that something has to change. And so I start with the solutions. And I think Frances Haugen, who I got to meet with for nearly an hour last week, I think she is a catalyst to change because it's understandable when you have kids being sent to content and accounts being that they are seeing with names like Eternally Starving and I Want to Be Perfect and these kinds of things, you've got a problem. So number one, we need federal privacy laws. The states is a patchwork. We're one of the few countries in the world that doesn't have a federal privacy law, which would really help. Apple just told their users, well, you have to opt in if you want your data to be shared. 75% of them didn't want it shared. So let's look
at that. Instead of opt out, right?
Yeah, yes. Okay. So the second thing, and the, I think an opt-in would be much better. The second thing we need is to improve our kids' online laws. Right now, they only go up to age 13. You know, you could go up to 15. You can expand the protections that would really get at the Facebook stuff. The third thing, my work, competitive policy. I want to let the market work while we're doing regulations to try to develop some of these bells and whistles. And we'll never know what Instagram might have done on their own because Facebook bought them out. Because in the words of Mark Zuckerberg, he would rather buy than compete. He literally said in an email, this brand may be nascent, but it's well established and it could be disruptive to us. Well, it was. He just didn't know how. So the final thing is, and there's competitive policy, is making it easier for people to compete with the dominant platforms, you know, by saying that you can't promote your own products. You have to treat people fairly on the platforms. It's not as intuitive, but it really could get at this from a market-based approach. And there's a lot of Republican interest in it. And I put forward a number of bills with more to come.
Just to clarify something, so you're basically saying, Senator, supporting mini Facebooks, supporting companies that do the same thing. And well, they have a monopoly, right? So
they'll develop. What if you had one where you had to register the kids so you know exactly who's on there, or they can't be on there unless they say who they are? What if you know, there's all kinds of different products that could go along, but it is so hard right now. And this is the long-term approach that isn't just about Facebook. It's really, there's too much consolidation in our country in general. Then the final one, which is you're getting at, is misinformation and trying to regulate that. So I was on Dana Bash on Sunday, and I use the example, I'd just seen the James Bond movie, and I was sitting in there thinking, okay, if someone yells fire in this theater, it's not protected speech, right? Okay. But if the theater decided then to put in speakers in all their multiplexes, because they were playing the James Bond movie in all these different theaters, and they then broadcast that, no one would think that was okay. There'd be some kind of a lawsuit, right? Or if you yelled out vaccine misinformation in one theater, okay, the theater's not going to be in trouble for that. But the theater will be in trouble if they start broadcasting things everywhere that's wrong. And so that's what's going on here. I think you have to get at when they amplify things, when they're making money off of amplifying things, that there could be some loss of their liability protection. Right now, they can do whatever they want. I have a bill with Ben Ray Lujan that I put out months ago that would actually say they lose their immunity when they put out misinformation on vaccines in the middle of any public health crisis, because it has been, the repercussions have been astronomical. Over 50% of the people that don't get the vaccine say they read something on social media that, you know, a microchip is implanted in their arm. Well, that concept is a version of what we could be looking at. And I will note, YouTube just recently announced that they were banning all accounts, misinformation on vaccines. And Facebook has not taken that step yet. So it's hard to sort through all this. And the algorithm amplification immunity piece, I will admit, is the hardest part of how you get this right while still protecting free speech. But it is key to some of the success of moving on this. You also have other countries that are being more aggressive than us. Because in our country, Congress is just, the tech companies have been hiring everyone. People listen to their lobbyists all the time. It is incredibly frustrating. The answer is in how much money they're making off of us. They're making off of you, Katie, $51 Facebook every quarter. And that's nearly double what the amount is in other industrialized nations. So that's because they have more protections for you, for your data, and you're not as profitable to them. And so it's really disturbing. And that just shows why that we haven't put any protections in place.
Are there any countries that you feel are a role model? Because they also don't have the First Amendment.
Sometimes
honestly problematic, because some of the steps they're taking, say in Germany and other countries, could
especially
not be
with
taken
elections
here.
They're able to just take stuff off immediately. Well, Europe is doing a lot on competition policy, and I've worked with Margaret Vestager. She's the competition person for the EU extensively. I noticed that the whistleblower is actually going to speak with some of those, the people in Europe leading the way. So at first everyone was making fun of Europe, and now I think everyone realizes why they were doing some of the things. So you're right about the First Amendment, but in competition policy, our antitrust laws haven't been changed for decades now. And in history, they were always changed. We had the Sherman Act and the Clayton Act. That's how they broke up Standard Oil. That's how they broke up AT&T later. Over many different political administrations, they worked on that case. And so that means resources in the agencies. It means smart leaders in charge of them, which is happening. It means political support on both sides of the aisle. And there were some during the last administration, some good people in charge of those divisions that were doing some good work. And it really means updating our laws. So there's a fit. How could you have the tech industry, 20% of our economy now come in, and we make not one change to our competition policy or privacy laws? That is our status right now. So I think we have to admit that people have been listening to these lobbies. It's too hard. You got the filibuster hanging out there, which is not as big a problem here, but it's more giving in to the tech industry. And I don't wish them harm. They employ many people. They've given us great things. I'm wearing a Fitbit right now. I got, you know, my iPhone right here. I'm not some Luddite, but I believe in capitalism. And if you believe in capitalism, you don't want to destroy these companies. You just want to make sure that there's competitors in place. And this is not just Facebook. And that's one of the things I'm concerned about, because it really is. We have to look at the tech industry as a whole.
Hey, would you ever consider running for president again in 2024?
I love my job, Katie. I love it. And now I've got so much to do. I'm going off to do a prescription drug event in Minnesota. And I have really a major leadership role in the Senate right now. That's what I'm focused on.
Thank you again to my special guest, Senator Amy Klobuchar. She's so smart and with it. I really like talking to her. For more information about breast cancer or any cancer screening, you can go to cancer.gov, and you can also check out the Stand Up to Cancer website. And if you want more of the nitty-gritty of my on-air colonoscopy, as well as my cancer advocacy work, you can read all about it in my new memoir, Going There, which is out October 26th. So pre-order, people. Next Question with Katie Couric is a production of iHeartMedia and Katie Couric Media. The executive producers are me, Katie Couric, and Courtney Litz. The supervising producer is Lauren Hansen. Associate producers, Derek Clements, Adriana Fazio, and Emily Pinto. The show is edited and mixed by Derek Clements. For more information about today's episode or to sign up for my morning newsletter, Wake Up Call, go to katiecouric.com. You can also find me at Katie Couric on Instagram and all my social media channels. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.